While Wisconsin is a state that most of its life has featured one-party dominance or three-party battles, it is now one of the closest two-party states in the country. No party can count on victory, and often, as in the 2000 and 2004 presidential votes, the results are incredibly close. How is Wisconsin's electorate likely to vote in this very interesting election of 2008? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
What are the voting blocks in Wisconsin? How have its various ethnic and religious groups tended to vote in the past? And how do they vote today? What have been the major successes and failures of the major parties in Wisconsin? Why has Wisconsin become such a hotbed of third parties, such as the Socialists, the Progressives, and the Prohibition Party? Our answers will come from a longtime student of Wisconsin politics. He's Robert Booth Fowler, professor emeritus of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and the author of various books, including Wisconsin Votes, an Electoral History, published in 2008 by the University of Wisconsin Press.
And welcome back to University of the Year.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
One of the things I enjoyed besides reading your book was the appendix at the back where you list all the presidential elections and how Wisconsin voted, starting with choosing the wrong candidate in the first presidential election. Can you take us back to 1848 when Wisconsin became a state and tell us, to begin with, who was voting?
Okay. In 1848, of course, it was men, not women, who could vote. And at the Constitutional Convention setting up Wisconsin Constitution, there was very little discussion of women voting, but a great deal of discussion of whether African Americans could vote. That was actually quite a hot topic. Wisconsin had a reputation at that time of being somewhat of a reform state, with a lot of people who were quite upset about slavery and hoping to incorporate African Americans into the electorate, though of course there were virtually very, very few African Americans in Wisconsin at the time. But through a series of complicated votes and decisions at the Constitutional Convention, otherwise African Americans did not acquire the vote at this time. Who else could vote? Well, what was unusual probably about Wisconsin was two groups. One was that if you were a non-citizen but an immigrant, you really could vote in Wisconsin, and you could vote really up until about the end approximately of the 19th century. And of course, we can't imagine this today because we have millions of people in the United States who are not citizens, and of course they can't vote. But in Wisconsin in the 19th century, they could vote, and that was because Wisconsin was such a overwhelmingly immigrant state. Many, many of these immigrants were from abroad, and neither of the political parties at the time wished to offend these huge proportions of the electorate. So you could vote if you were an immigrant and not a citizen, which is pretty darn unusual, as I say. The other area where you place where you could vote was that certain American Indians could vote, which is quite unusual. This had to do with procedures where if an Indian tribe agreed to certain property arrangements, basically to instead of having a reservation to subdivide their land into individual plots, which one tribe did, then you were considered to be close enough to the white way of life, unquote, to vote. We have no knowledge that any such American Indians actually did vote, but it was possible if you were part of this kind of a tribe. But the most outstanding point is that male immigrants could vote here and kept right on voting, whether they were citizens or not.
Did they vote as blocks?
Well, it depends on the group, but many, many elements of European immigration did vote as blocks, largely. Of course, every voter is an individual, and it's always a matter of relative distribution in groups. But Wisconsin voting behavior in the 19th century and to some extent thereafter can fairly reasonably be understood in terms of patterns of immigrant and religious voting. Ethnicity and religion were absolutely crucial.
We think of in 1848 and the years following, of you have presumably a large Norwegian contingent, a large German contingent, Irish, Yankee contingent, which would be more indigenous.
Right. Well, if you take, say, 1890, let's say, as a sort of period where things were fairly settled in terms of immigrant pattern, you have the following picture. You have your Norwegian and Scandinavian voters, and these voters were overwhelmingly, almost monolithically Republican. And that was associated with their belief, Protestant religion, which generally meant Republican in Wisconsin.
Now, when you say Republican, though, you're meaning it in the earlier party of Abraham Lincoln kind of Republican party?
Absolutely, yes. So very much so. The one exception was that a little bit is that after the 1880s, there was some interest, especially in the Swedish American communities, in the Prohibition Party. There was a sort of pietist element there. But by far the largest groups were, of course, the German Americans. And as you know, Wisconsin, even at the 2000 census, is the second most German-American state in the Union. And really, it's number one because North Dakota is slightly ahead, but most of the – or a great many of the North Dakota Germans are actually from Russia. We don't need to go into that story. But if you say directly from Germany, we are – and 43%. So – and these German immigrants, of course, began coming in huge numbers well before 1860. So they became a factor – tremendous factor right away before the Scandinavians, for example.
With a big – but I would think the Germans would have a big reputation for reform.
Well,
does that square with republicanism?
They didn't have a reputation particularly for reform. But the problem with them in terms of influence was that on the whole, German Americans were deeply divided in their voting behavior by religion, so that the Catholic Wisconsinites in the 19th century were Democrats. So that meant German Catholics. It meant Dutch Catholics. It meant, of course, Irish Catholics, and the Irish were the second largest group in Wisconsin. And even in the 2000 census, they're second largest at 11%. And eventually it meant Polish. They came, Czechs. So you had a huge group there. But the Germans didn't get the influence they could have gotten because they were so divided in their voting behavior because of religion. When the Germans first came, they identified themselves not as Germans. After all, Germany wasn't founded really as a nation until 1870, 71. They came as, you know, I'm from the Rhineland or I'm from Bavaria. But that didn't last too long because once you come into an environment where the other people are not Germans, they see you as German. You speak German. So culturally, they became identified in Germans. And by very, very quickly, the background tended to slip away by the next generation. They were just German. But German didn't mean unified politically. Over time, why they all started as Democrats, but over time, more and more the Protestant Germans tended to edge away from what was seen as the Catholic Democratic Party in Wisconsin.
So in those early elections, let's go back to the 1848 and some of the early elections, whether it was for governor or president, what did the parties mean? I mean, if you have Republican and Democrat, what does it actually stand for at that time?
Right. Well, at first in Wisconsin, there wasn't, as you realize, any Republican Party. It was the Democrats, the Whigs, and then usually a third party, which of one sort or another, which was generally focused on ending the spread of slavery, if not slavery itself. That was sort of the Reform Party. And that party, whether it was the Liberty Party or whatever, depending on the election, that party was a Reform Party and it had a sort of cohesion. But the other parties were, shall we say, very loose jointed, and we might describe them as parties of opportunity for politicians. But fairly quickly, people acquired a identity, I would say, about the two parties. And an awful lot of Wisconsin politics was voting certainly was, and I would contend, is identity politics, meaning us versus them. And in Wisconsin, the us was generally the Protestants, the Yankees, as you say, the Dutch Protestants, increasingly the German Protestants, and the Scandinavians versus the them, which were the Catholics. Or you can reverse it around as to who was us and them. But very much identity politics. So you have two levels. You have sort of political manifestos, which were issued at election time. But in general, I don't think they had much to do with how people actually voted. There are exceptions in particular elections. But on the whole, people acquired a political identity. And as you know, voting behavior was quite stable in the 19th century, which means it didn't matter a great deal what the particular issues were most of the time. It was identity politics. You knew who you were and who your people were, if I may phrase it that way.
You identified with the party. Yeah.
And of course, that was the party was part of the package.
So who'd we vote for as a state and why?
Okay. Well, at the beginning, Wisconsin was narrowly a Democratic state. And that was very typical of frontier states. It's sort of hard to believe that Wisconsin was on the frontier at one time, and certainly so in the 1840s. And so that would be very typical of frontier states. But as the slavery issue heated up, moving toward 1860, the Republican Party comes to be founded. And the way the electoral mix was at that time, the Republicans came to dominance quite quickly in Wisconsin, keeping in mind that the Democrats were a strong alternative. And thereafter, after the Civil War and so on, the Republicans continued to be dominant almost the entire time, really, with an occasional election exception, until about the 1890s. And that just turned around the mix of people that were here and the patterns. As more people like Polish Americans or Czech Americans and so on came, they voted Democratic. They were offset by the movement of Protestant Germans to the Republican Party, and that kept the Republicans in power. But it was usually very close, very close. So it was a funny thing. You had in many ways, you had one party dominance in a very close two-party system. But voting was so stabilized that you could have that arrangement year after year.
Was it coincidental that the Republican Party was founded in Wisconsin?
Well, I'm glad you said it was founded in Wisconsin. You do realize that that's a disputed issue, and in Michigan they claim it was founded there.
Oh, what do they know?
Right. Well, I think it's not a coincidence in this sense that there was a substantial Yankee reform element that was quite influential in Wisconsin politics before 1860. And we have data on who attended the founding of these conventions, just like we do with who attended the Constitutional Convention. And like a great many reform movements of the 19th century, and maybe every century, I'm not sure, it was generally upper middle class Yankees who had a lot to do with getting this thing going. But they had appeal with other groups. For example, Scandinavian Americans on the whole were very hostile to slavery and the extension of slavery and quickly came on board with the new Republican Party. But the Republican Party didn't, as the 19th century went on, the Republican Party was not at all an agency of reform, nor was the Democratic Party. Both parties were essentially controlled by one perspective or one interest, you could put it either way, which was economic development would be a pleasant way of putting it if you want it. But they were controlled by big business interests. And
not to say land barons.
Right, and that
robber
too.
Barons.
But the funny thing is that you had this disconnect again where these two parties were really controlled by similar interests. But the voters were not oriented around these kind of concerns. They were oriented more around these identity issues and tradition. You know, Dad was a Republican and so I am and so on. You know, Dad was a Democrat, so I am, that sort of thing. So you had somewhat of a disconnect. Reform elements, probably the biggest reform elements, I would say, in the 19th century was the Prohibition movement beginning in the 1880s. And it was led by quite a similar group of people to the people who had, before the Civil War, been very directed against slavery and in Wisconsin.
John Olin ran the temperance ticket to become governor of Wisconsin
right.
And settled for being president of the University of Wisconsin.
Right. Yes, it was very much so. And in the 1880s, they got some votes. At first, when they appeared, the Republican Party was very nervous. because they realized that virtually every vote that was going – I mean, the Democratic Party on the whole was not composed of people who were interested in prohibition. I mean, German Americans on the whole were hardly the leadership. This would be true of the Irish and Polish and so on. So it was coming from the Republicans. But the Republican Party knew that it was only a very small element. And so they were worried at first that prohibition would hurt them, but the Prohibition Party would hurt them. But the Prohibition Party, while it continued on for decades and actually became quite a radical party over time, very much in favor of women's suffrage and women's rights and so on, didn't attract much after an initial burst of enthusiasm.
And as you were looking over records, you know, because you went back and looked at who was voting and how the turnouts came, what surprised you looking back at the 19th century, the time of Lincoln and these early elections? What did you find out that you didn't expect to see?
Well, I had thought that Wisconsin was much more a – I knew it was a steadily Republican state in the 19th century. What I didn't realize was how very, very close it was. And I knew very little about the ethnic bases, ethnic and religious bases of the different two-party coalitions. And when you're doing something like this, you're looking at a lot of specific places. And that was fun because you learned a lot of things like one of my favorites is that, you know, Madison, Wisconsin, why it has been pretty much a Democratic city all the way. And that was too bad, for example, for Abraham Lincoln, who was not a winner here and so on. So, I mean, I don't know. I just – it's – to me, of course, I'm absolutely fascinated by the topic. So virtually everything I found was fascinating. And I still am. I taught this course this spring with a bunch of freshmen and sophomores. And they did these – research papers, and some of them were absolutely fabulous, again, exploring their hometowns and their voting history. And if there's ever to be a revision of this, why, I've got some new data that they provided. But when you study voting behavior over time, it's one way you're really studying, in this case, the Wisconsin people. It's more than cold statistics. You're studying what things appear to matter, at least as expressed in this particular way.
The values of
the values,
that population.
Right. Absolutely. And so it's for me, it's a tremendous education.
Did you see elections in which the outcome in Wisconsin clearly was affected by, oh, we have suddenly this large immigrant population added to the state? In other words, we're not talking about a stable population, as we've said. We're talking about a state that's constantly changing in the 19th century in particular with these influxes of immigration. Did you see elections that were pretty clearly affected by
those? Well, the classic one was the race for governor in 1890. There was a law passed by the Wisconsin legislature which specified that basic subjects, wherever they were taught in Wisconsin schools, had to be taught in English. Well, that really tore it because a tremendous number of people were being educated in parochial, and parochial included a lot of Lutheran Protestant schools as well, in German. Plus, there were plenty of public schools which were semi-English, semi-German operations and so on. And this law would have definitely changed these. But, of course, its real importance, as everybody understood at the time, was symbolic. It was a way of saying you need to Americanize and stop teaching people, especially German, but it had applied to some others as well. And so there was quite an uproar, and the mistake – and this came through Republican administration – the mistake was to not hide this. So there was a lot of opposition. As a result, this was one of the few elections where the Republicans were thoroughly defeated in Wisconsin because of the feeling that you're slapping down the immigrants. So that wasn't a good strategy. I mean, if you're thinking strategically, but it was just a terrible mistake. And the famous line that William Vilas gave was that two and plus two equals four, no matter what the language. And of course, not everyone saw it that way. But of course, immediately the problem for the Democrats was, well, they won this big election. now, including control of the state legislature. Well, of course, they have to deliver. That is, they have to repeal this law. But in repealing the law, they lose the reason that they were elected. So it's one of those ironies of politics. It didn't help them for the long run. But in the short run, it was a beautiful thing for them.
More on Wisconsin voting history when we continue in a moment with the University of the Year.
Get involved with Wisconsin culture, arts, humanities, and history by visiting portalwisconsin.org from the Cultural Coalition of Wisconsin, including WPR. Learn something new or just have fun at portalwisconsin.org.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Booth Fowler, and our topic for this hour of discussion, Wisconsin voting patterns over the years and how, in particular, immigration has affected voting in Wisconsin. Was immigration a factor in the rise of probably the most successful third party to come out of Wisconsin, the Progressive Party? Where did that come from?
Well, the Progressive Party actually, with a capital P and a capital P, really was a phenomenon of the 1930s. So by that time, really the Depression was the crucial feature in creating a third party, because at that time in the 1930s, both the Republican Party and the Wisconsin Democratic Party, which was quite conservative and was not at all a Franklin Roosevelt party, neither of them were providing an outlet for people who wanted a substantial change. And so it was an opportunity for the next generation of La Follettes to create the party. And as long as things were rolling along well for them, for a few years, it was very strong. But as soon as conditions began to change, why, its fate changed also.
And if we're looking at the development of the Progressive Party, does it go back to some of the socialists and some of the earlier attempts to reform things here?
Well, you know, that takes us back to Robert La Follette Sr. And as you know, Robert La Follette Sr. was Republican all the way. The only time he was not a Republican, of course, was when he ran for president in 1924. But he otherwise continued. Of course, he died the next year, 1925. But what you had once La Follette got going was a division within the Republican Party. So Wisconsin really became, after, say, 1900, there had been plenty of these divisions before, but it became very intense. You had three parties. You had the Democratic Party, you had the more conservative Republicans, and you had what we call the liberal Republicans, which La Follette headed up. And these parties battled it out right up to the 1930s and the New Deal. And eventually, of course, Phil La Follette, really the founder, I would say, of the Progressive Party in the 1930s, realized that he just couldn't control the Republican Party. And so the conservative wing of the Republican Party was hopeless. And the La Follettes never considered the Democratic Party. It was too ethnic, too Catholic, and too conservative. So of course there's a link all the way back to the senior La Follettes. But with the socialists, that's a different issue entirely. And Wisconsin has a fascinating and huge history of socialism, which I think a lot of people really don't realize anymore. That this
coming
really,
out of Milwaukee mostly? Mm-hmm.
Yes. Oh, yes. Well, actually, talk about ethnicity. The most ethnic party in Wisconsin history was the Socialist Party, in the sense that it was mostly overwhelmingly German-American, but in a very special location, occupationally and, of course, geographically, Milwaukee. But they were not very sympathetic to Robert La Follette Sr. and vice versa. They felt he was a tepid reformer, and if you know, are we really going to get serious about economic change and equality, or are we? And they felt that he wasn't. And of course, he wasn't too happy with them either, because they really were splitting potential They were competitors, let's put it that way, for what we call reform or radical votes. And La Follette's greatest strength, you know, Robert La Follette's greatest strength was not in the cities, partly because the biggest city by far, of course, was Milwaukee. And the Socialist Party was generally the strongest there, very often anyway. He wasn't particularly popular with affluent middle-class Yankee Republicans. They tend to support the conservative Republican. His greatest strength really lay in small town and rural areas, and of course, famously, especially with Scandinavian Americans. But he had a great many other supporters too, because there weren't enough Scandinavian Americans to make the difference.
Can you help me kind of picture, because, you know, we're used to seeing political candidates in a debate and they're arguing over one issue after the next. If you put, let's say, a socialist mayor of Milwaukee mm-hmm. next to Robert La Follette and next to some sort of spokesman from the Democratic Party and from the Republican Party, you took one issue, how would they be speaking?
Well, let's take the issue maybe of, let's put ourselves in, I don't know, how about 1910?
Sounds good.
And there they are. Well, let's say, how do you feel about the income tax? All the parties supported this, you might so you might say, well, there's no – but from the socialists, well, the income tax is fine, but you really need to have a very, very sharp income tax, which will get those capitalists. And La Follette did not spend time saying, let's get the capitalists. He spent time saying, well, we need the state to regulate business. We need the state to provide some equal opportunity. We need the state to protect workers and farmers. But there's a difference between somebody who says we really need to take over the economic means of production. So that's the socialists. The Democrats, generally speaking, La Follette's reforms, economic ones in particular, are viewed with great, great caution. It sounds like he loves the government. And he was a big state Republican. There's no question about that. And the Democratic Party was, along with the conservative wing of the Republican Party, were small state people. So whatever the issue, La Follette tended to want to expand the government, expand regulation in moderation to create, quote, more fairness. The socialists wanted the government to take over. And the conservative Republicans, Democrats said, leave it alone. And I think it was illustrated when in 1932, unexpectedly in the Roosevelt landslide, the Democrats won control of Wisconsin state government. And the person elected, Schmiederman, was the mayor of Madison, conservative Democrat. And all sorts of things happened during this intense depression period. And his general reaction was, well, we don't want the government to get too much involved. That reflected the, at that time, state conservative Democratic view. And Phil La Follette found it fairly easy to beat him in the next election in that era of we want government action on the progressive ticket. Of course, over time after World War II, the Democratic Party evolved into the liberal and more state-oriented Democratic Party that we know today. But that was not true historically. You see, the reason was that the Democratic Party in Wisconsin had been made up of Catholic immigrants and their children. And they didn't want government because when they thought of government, they thought it was the Yankees and the Protestants are going to make us do things. And you know, it's how you use the word reform. Government wasn't a reform institution for them. It was going to be a dominant cultural group was going to oppress them. And so they wanted weak government. It made sense to them.
If we go back to that year you mentioned, though, 1910, move forward a little bit, and we're talking about a lot of Germans, both Catholics and Protestants in Wisconsin, and then World War I comes along.
Right.
How did that affect Wisconsin voting?
Well, it affected it enormously because, unfortunately, Wisconsin, after war was declared, the United States entered it in 1917. For about a two-year period, Wisconsin had a disgraceful, if you'll forgive me for saying this, record of treating many German Americans, especially in areas where they weren't numerically dominant. There was a lot of you must buy war bonds and persecution and so on. And a whole series of German institutions dropped their names, German Bank, and so it became Bank. Well, you get the idea. Mm-hmm. Though, of course, many, many places in Wisconsin names remain in terms of locations. But there was far too much persecution. And the result was twofold in terms of voting behavior. One, there was temporarily, especially in 1918, which would be right during the war, a tremendous swing to the Socialist Party because the Democratic Party was the party in power. So there was no sympathy for Woodrow Wilson. And the Republican Party was in competition with the Democratic Party in Wisconsin to see who was the most super patriotic, which often led to these abuses. And so they turned first to socialism. But after the war, there was very definitely a movement toward the Republican Party. You were repudiating Woodrow Wilson and so on. But that was true of almost all aspects of the electorate because, you know, the war to end wars and the Treaty of Versailles and the whole thing was a huge mess. And so the Republicans had a wonderful, wonderful, glorious era from their perspective in the 1920s in Wisconsin. That was one-party government, and it wasn't close.
And if we take it into 1920 when women get the vote, yes. How do you see that affecting Wisconsin politics?
Well, women's suffrage is a fascinating topic. People often, I don't know exactly where this came about, believe that Wisconsin was a pioneering state in women's suffrage. Nothing could be further from the truth. And all you have to do is know something about the ethnic cultures which were central to Wisconsin and their attitudes regarding the role of women. And I've had many students, as well as myself, who have studied the Wisconsin. We had a vote on women's suffrage in 1912. And they're always surprised. It's overwhelmingly voted down. Well, couldn't this be true as late as 1912? Yes. And if you understand the ethnic makeup of Wisconsin. And, of course, the strongest support for women's suffrage in 1912 came generally in Scandinavian areas. It doesn't mean it was overwhelmingly strong, but often ran about 50%. And this paralleled the development of suffrage in Scandinavia. So there was a sort of an evolving tradition which many of these people reflected and obviously shared that women should vote. But if you turn to again, by far the most important element, ethnic group, German Americans, they may have been divided politically in their voting, but not on women's suffrage. No. And overwhelmingly so. I mean, it's amazing. For example, the Wisconsin Socialist Party, which as I've indicated was largely ethnic, endorsed women's suffrage and vote 1912. But however, every single socialist German ward in Milwaukee voted down. So, you can talk at one level, but you have to get to the voters. So this was a hard state from the point of view of women's suffrage. Once women got the vote, of course, there was an increase in voting. But studies have shown that in heavily ethnic, if that makes any sense, states, women's entrance into the electorate after the adoption of the 19th Amendment was slower than in, say, Yankee areas. And of course, that simply reflects, again, understanding about what would be appropriate for women. But over time, of course, that obviously has completely changed.
I gather it was not very close when it came to voting on prohibition, either to enact or repeal.
Right. Prohibition's another fascinating one because obviously this is not the state that you would want to make your basis of your campaign. And we know it for better or for worse in 2008, but believe me, it wasn't any different then. What happened was that there were, again, these reform elements, even before the Civil War. The same ones who were often very much critical of slavery were often pushing for various kinds of prohibition or at least ways to try to control the bars. And this effort continued, but as I've mentioned, neither party wanted much to do with that in Wisconsin because the tremendous support for drinking was always present. Obviously, this is a big German state, and it was just routine that you would – I mean, a working man would, of course, have a beer for lunch, and that's just was part of the culture. I mean, it had nothing to do with, if I may be allowed to make this statement, nothing to do with getting blind drunk. It was more of a cultural kind of drinking of beer. And so there were some places, eventually local option, allowing localities to do it. And over time, with a tremendous push by reformers, some places did. But there was considerable resistance. And eventually, of course, it was imposed from the national level, as women's suffrage was. And it wasn't very well received. And very quickly in Wisconsin, it began to be very widely flouted. We have national data that shows that prohibition probably was effective, especially at first in the country as a whole. But in Wisconsin, it came to be a problem. And certainly there was intense opposition. And there was a vote in 1926 on trying to modify to allow some kinds of drinking in Wisconsin, which of course wasn't going anywhere because it would be unconstitutional. But again, a lot of time votes have nothing to do with what's actually going to. And Wisconsin, of course, you know, overwhelmingly voted for this. And you could see the same ethnic breakdowns that you would expect. The weakest support for it, for changing and moving, came in some Yankee areas. And by the way, in all of these reform movements, women's suffrage, anti-slavery, prohibition, and so on, of course, women organizations were at the center of these. And in fact, the whole getting back to women's suffrage, I mean, that was a case, it's a fascinating one, where women activists were central in trying to push it. And unfortunately, there was often a giant cultural divide between these women who were generally middle-class and upper-middle-class Yankee, well-educated women, and the ethnic people they went out talking to. They tried very hard to do things like publish their manifestos in, quote, foreign languages, unquote. But I don't think they could overcome very often the cultural divisions. I mean, one just cannot see some of these people showing up in a German town in, say, Winnebago County and, I mean, saying to these men, you ought to vote for women's suffrage. The gap was just too enormous. But it's fascinating. It's fascinating in terms of the cultural politics is so much of politics, I think, and so much of voting.
We'll get some idea as to how Wisconsin got to be the way it is today, that state which neither party can count on, right after this. This is University of the Air.
When you call us, we'll listen. Wisconsin Public Radio has knowledgeable and friendly people who are ready to help you. Call us at 1-800-747-7444 with your comments, questions, or suggestions.
What do these men have in common? Lewis Cass, James Blaine, Charles Hughes, Thomas Dewey, and Michael Dukakis. Well, they're all men who won the presidential election here in Wisconsin, but obviously did not go on to win the White House. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland, and our guest is Robert Booth Fowler, whose recent book is Wisconsin Votes and Electoral History. We're talking about the history of Wisconsin voting. We haven't talked much about how Wisconsin was perceived by the nation as a whole and how important its elections were. How did, you know, was Wisconsin a swing state?
Generally not.
Yeah.
Generally, it would be carried by the Republicans. So, and after all, it wasn't that big a state in terms of the number of electoral votes it had. And so, and in the 1890s, it was a state that was closely contested. And so there was some effort by the National Democrats to carry it. But generally, it was seen as a Republican state, even though there were exceptions.
Milwaukee, Madison, other enclaves that the Democrats could count on in Wisconsin?
Well, there weren't many. I mean, Milwaukee after the 1870s was more inclined to be Republican plus over time socialist. Yes, there were loads of Democratic enclaves because areas that were German Catholic or Irish Catholic and so on were solidly Democratic, but overall it would be carried by the Republicans, and that was pretty much the assumption.
So when did it get to be a state that sort of was so close and how?
Well, it's actually quite recent. The basic pattern, I guess, continued to be Republican in the 1940s, in the 1950s. But in the 1960s, you began to see quite a bit of change. The crucial breakthrough year for the Democrats was actually 1957, when Senator Proxmire was elected in a special election to replace Senator Joseph McCarthy. It wasn't clear that there would be any long-run significance to this victory. Proxmire had run repeatedly for governor, was very well known. It was an off-year election, and a lot of strange things can happen in that sort of situation. But the next year, 1958, was a big Democratic year nationally. And the Democrats were able to win the governorship, Gaylord Nelson. And so the Democrats became a serious force starting then, late 50s, early 60s. And it's been quite competitive ever since, I would say.
Wisconsin went pretty solidly for Kennedy in 60.
The challenge in 1960 was that Wisconsin simply wasn't a Catholic enough state. But no.
So Nixon won.
Yeah. But it has voted for a number of Democratic candidates for president, for Lyndon Johnson, Jimmy Carter, and so on. It's voted these days, recent decades, more often for the Democrat for president than not.
So did it go for Nixon again in 68 then, over Humphrey?
Yes. So it's been a case of but that you know, that's a very strange. Well, every election's strange.
I was trying to look,
fascinating.
I was trying to look for some sort of a pattern when I was reading
there
over
isn't one.
Who won for president. That's the thing.
Well, that's why you have a very close state.
Yeah.
Yes, you have a very close state, so you don't have a pattern. I mean, the number of people who are actually voting independents, as you know, in Wisconsin, as in the nation, is much, much smaller than the number of people who claim they are independents. This is one of the fascinating phenomena. In America, many people, it's considered it's sort of polite to say, well, I'm sort of an independent. But a great many of these people aren't. And so Wisconsin—
You mean they vote consistently for
yes,
the same party?
Mm-hmm. That's fine. What I'm suggesting is you have a pretty stabilized constituency for both parties today. But there's a relatively small group of people who will make the difference. And these people are generally independents authentically. I don't mean someone who is, you know, I'm a Democrat, but I'll occasionally vote for Republican. I don't – that isn't really an independent. And the independents on the whole nationally, as you know, are among the – all things being equal, among the less informed voters. Partisans tend to be more informed, especially if they're interested partisans, than do swing independents. So candidate image, as we say in political science, can make a difference in these close elections. So somebody who can create a good candidate image in Wisconsin is able to get the marginal number in a close two-party state. And Wisconsin, this has, of course, been a big deal because Wisconsin has this carefully nurtured self-image of liking independent politicians and politicians with an interesting self-presentation. So, you know, you have Governor Dreyfus with his red vest. You have the La Follettes. You have Senator Feingold. You have Governor Thompson. I mean, this is the way it is. And it's third-party land. And, of course, it continues. I mean, the classic case, big time, was the Perot vote here, which was amazing in 1992.
And, that is fascinating.
Yeah, I got a tremendous vote. But just recently in the 2002 gubernatorial race, Ed Thompson rolled up quite a vote as an independent. So if you have the right candidate image, you can do okay. But note that all of these recent third-party people lost. So we don't want to overdo that.
What difference do you think it makes that you now have a much more active and enfranchised African-American population and so on than back at the beginning?
It makes a tremendous difference to the Wisconsin Democratic Party because though African-American electorate, I don't know, might be 5%, but the African-American population is around 6%. It's not a big element. As it's not, this is not South Carolina or New York. But, of course, it's a crucial element for the Democratic Party because the vote is so overwhelmingly. In fact, in recent elections, Wisconsin African-American voters are voting at an even higher rate for the Democrats than African-Americans in the nation. By a couple percentage points, but it's in the middle early 90% plus. So it's a huge factor. And this will be a huge factor in 2008 presidential election because there will be, of course, a tremendous effort to by the Democratic Party of Wisconsin to capitalize on the fact that the Democratic presidential nominee is African-American. So there will be a huge effort to get maximum registration and vote, and I would expect that will be so. But overall in the state, African-American population is small. This remains way up there in terms of a percentage of whites in the United States in a state. You know, this is a 90% plus white state. And the other thing, too, is African-Americans – I mean, it's very interesting. If you look at all the localities in Wisconsin, you see a big difference between African-Americans and Latinos, Hispanics.
In terms of the way they vote?
No, in terms of the way they live.
Oh.
African-American population is really quite concentrated in Milwaukee, Racine, Madison, so on. But most places in Wisconsin have no African-Americans, zero. But that's not true at all. Latinos. Latinos are in most places in Wisconsin, very small percentage. But one of the things that, you know, they are a very, very tiny factor in electoral pattern now, Wisconsin. But of course, it will grow. And I think it's going to be very fascinating because as a population is distributed, the question is, will they take on the politics of the particular locality they're in and thus might have a much more diverse voting behavior than we have among African Americans? And we don't know a lot about what little voting there is because it's a very small group. And, of course, there's a citizenship issue and so on of Hispanics. In fact, I had a student this past semester who tried very hard. I, in the book, discuss what I consider to be the, what we know of their voting behavior. But he did a wonderful paper working with census data in Milwaukee. And he concluded that, Professor, you better be very careful about your claims. It's very hard to document it. It was a wonderful paper.
As we go into the 2008 election, what are the blocks that will fall behind each party?
Well, put crudely, it looks like this. The Republican Party in Wisconsin is based – electoral block is based basically on two pillars. Pillar one is the suburban Milwaukee vote. And of course, there are different suburbs and so on. I mean, I'll spare you all the details. But fundamentally, it's a very Republican area. And so much so that today it effectively cancels the Democratic vote that comes out of the city of Milwaukee. So pillar one is suburban Milwaukee. Now, I say suburban Milwaukee because there are suburbs all over the state, but that's much more of a mixed picture. Milwaukee suburbs are very Republican, but Madison suburbs are quite Democratic. And it just depends. The suburbs outside of just across the river from Minneapolis and St. Paul, which are growing quite rapidly, are lean Republican. But it's a very mixed picture. But Milwaukee suburbs are crucial. They're big. They're growing. They're very Republican. And the second pillar, of course, are, all things being equal, frankly, German-American
still
areas. And there's no consciousness, of course. It's just these are the traditional areas. And, you know, it varies place to place. But all things being equal, you will find that German-American areas tend to be. And so if you were to look at a map of Wisconsin and you know where German-American rural and villages and even small cities that are heavily German, they tend to be Republican. And this is a substantial element of the population because if you take the Fox River Valley away, you take Madison, Milwaukee suburbs, and some of the other smaller cities, you've still got about a third of the state. And a good chunk of that third is still largely German American. So those are the two pillars. And the two pillars for the Democratic Party, of course, is obviously Milwaukee. And Madison. And Madison today is 1950, Madison and Dane County cast 5% of the state vote. Is Madison, Dane County are now up to 10%. And of course, much more Democratic than they were then. Moreover, Madison is spreading everywhere around. So it's Iowa County, it's into northern Rock County, it's Iowa County, it's Greene County, it's Columbia County, it's Sauk County. So many people coming to Madison. Madison culture, I mean, everyone is different and unique. I think I've made that point. But we see the effect. All these places are becoming more democratic. And so Madison is increasing influence. I mean, there are other areas that are important. Northern Wisconsin tends to be democratic. It became so during the New Deal, a lot of poor areas, but they don't cast very many votes, et cetera. So those are the main areas. Let me give you what I think is the challenges for what it's worth for each of the two major candidates, okay? One, for the Republican candidate, McCain, I think his challenge is basically going to be dealing with the war. Wisconsin has this long tradition of being unsympathetic with wars, and this goes all the way back, as you pointed out, mm-hmm. And so people say, well, you know, people against the wars, you know, a bunch of Madison kooks. I mean, they don't say this in Madison, but they say this outstate. But that's a misunderstanding because the German-American population was unsympathetic way back then, and this connection between traditional German areas and the Republican Party started firmly in 1940 when German-American areas realized that correctly that Roosevelt was going into World War II. And there was no sympathy for Nazism, you understand, but didn't want to. So the anti-war tradition is very broad in this state. And he is an ardent supporter of the war. So I think he's got trouble on that front because this is not the right state for that. This is not South Carolina or Georgia. Plus, the Republicans haven't won the presidential race. So he doesn't need to start behind anywhere. For Obama, I think that there's a cultural challenge here. And as I say, I think identity politics matters a lot more than surveys suggest to us. And yes, he may be very, very popular in Madison. And of course, he's going to do very well, obviously, in African-American areas. But he has to find a way to connect with the average Wisconsinite who is very far from Madison and often proud of it and very far from Milwaukee ditto. And that's going to be a challenge because there's just a cultural gap there, which is perfectly obvious. I'm not saying McCain can't overcome his challenge or Obama his, but Obama does have this advantage that all other things being equal, the Democrat will carry the state for president. And I'm predicting he will. That's a safe prediction because I'm making it here in June. I'm not going to be held to anything past this day. But I think that there's a cultural gap. He's got to be able to connect with people in the corner tavern. Now, he doesn't need the majority of those people. He's not going to get them. Some people argue that he can cut into the Republican strength in the Milwaukee suburbs. But I'm not convinced that's the case because I believe the campaign will bring to the fore his political stances, which will seem quite liberal. And I think that's not going to help him with suburban Milwaukee voters who are, on the whole, quite conservative. So I think it's going to be an absolutely fascinating, and I would say another close race in Wisconsin. And I note that both candidates are claiming they're going to be here plenty. And that tells you that
sure they will.
They see it the same way.
Well, Booth Fowler, thank you for projecting based on history.
Speculating, we call this.
Wisconsin voting, merely an indicator, not a promise. Thanks for being with us for this hour.
My pleasure.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air. Crowning achievement of Bach's choral output and one of the great works in the history of music. It's the Mass in B minor of Johann Sebastian Bach, and we'll have some insights into it and some good samples of it, too, next Sunday afternoon at 4 on University of the Air. Join us here on Wisconsin Public Radio.